Welcome to False Flag Weekly News, the one and only weekly news show that you need to stay abreast of the hideous, awful developments in today's world. However, today we are celebrating at least one news story, and that is the abrupt departure of National Security Advisor John Bolton, ex-National Security Advisor John Bolton. He's gotten the boot. He's out the door, and hopefully he won't trip on his mustache as he leaves. So today we have a fantastic new co-host, E. Michael Jones of Culture Wars Magazine, where you can see the whole new video archive, Culture Wars podcasts and so on at culturewars.com. I think Mike may be the leading Catholic intellectual in America today. It's an honor to have you. Welcome, Mike. How are you?
Thank you, Kevin. It's always good to be here.
Yeah, it's fun to talk, and I especially think it's going to be interesting to go through this list of stories we have today with you. So let's get at it, but first we have to do our quick, the obligatory disclaimer. We are a news and analysis criticism show. We critique the mainstream media. We explore alternative viewpoints. Many people find this excruciatingly disturbing, so please, if you can't handle it, turn off your computer right now and go someplace safer before we rock your world. Okay, well, that said, also, if you want to find out where to actually watch us, if you can handle this stuff, send an email to ffwn@nolivesradio.org, put join in the subject line, get on our email list, and we will be sure to inform you where you can see the show if we get banned or pushed from one location to another, which that sort of thing has been happening and brewing, so really helps if we know where to reach you. Okay, next, final PSA, here's our main story, the John Bolton firing. We'll be getting to that in a moment. And we do have one more PSA, though, which is the 9/11 anniversary events can be viewed at the No Lies Radio Archive. Just go to nolivesradio.org and you'll find the link to watch these great events. One of them I participated in here in San Francisco, California, where I'm broadcasting from a beautiful hotel room overlooking the Pacific Ocean. Who would think a guy like me could even afford to stay in such a place for 10 seconds, much less a full night or two, but here I am. All right, let's move on to the stories. E. Michael Jones, you're broadcasting from Pete Buttigieg's office, or across the alleyway from his office. That's an interesting location too. And so do you ever like lean out the window and yell, "Hey Pete, what happened to Building 7?
No, but I will the next time I see him.
There you go. So did you know that YouGov just did a poll showing that 52% of Americans who watch the controlled demolition of Building 7 on 9/11 from four different angles recognize it as a probable controlled demolition, while 21% don't, and 27% don't know. In a similar YouGov poll, apparently, after watching footage of the sunrise from four different angles, 52% of Americans say that the sun is a source of light, compared to 21% who say that it's a black hole sucking in light, and 27% are not sure. So I guess this is reassuring. What do you think, Mike?
Yeah, I think, well, there was just a study that came out said that it could not have happened the way they said it happened. This has always been the Achilles heel of the 9/11 conventional explanation. Nothing touched that building. And it collapsed within itself. And the only plausible explanation is that it was a controlled demolition. Now, once you establish that, I think you can establish that without a fact with Building 7. And at that point, you start to ask yourself, well, was that the case for the other buildings? Because they seem to have fallen in exactly the same way.
Yeah, it's really pretty obvious the more you look at them, the more you see these buildings were blown up with explosives. They didn't just fall down from random office fires. And it's not just people like us saying this, but the fire commissioners in Franklin Square and Munson Fire District in Queens, New York, passed a resolution last month, unanimously, by the way, calling for a new investigation into all aspects of 9/11. And they are quite outspoken about saying that it's obvious that explosives were used to murder a lot of their firefighter brothers and sisters. So this is big, especially if other fire departments pick this up. I have a friend in the Milwaukee Fire Department who told me years ago that everybody there knows about this. Well, it's one thing to know about it, another thing to do something about it. So, Mike, do you think the firefighters are going to lead the way to get a new investigation of this?
Well, this is the big issue. How do you overturn a conventional narrative? And generally, you can only overturn the conventional narrative if you overturn the government. So that the only way that the Stasi files became available was the collapse of the East German government. I think that what you're seeing here is this government has dug in its heels so deeply to defend this. They are willing to murder people. Osama bin Laden is the classic example. If the United States military had him within his power, wouldn't have made sense if they brought him back for a trial? Wouldn't that have shown that America represents the rule of law in the world? Isn't that what Tom Paine said? In America, the law is king. Well, why didn't that happen? Well, because they want to prevent a trial. Because a trial would mean evidence would be presented and people would have to testify under oath, and you might get to the bottom of what's happening. So what you're seeing here is the ever-increasing burden of lie. The burden weighs down more and more heavy on the population, because every time it becomes challenged, you have to add another lie to the burden of lies to keep this lie going. And this is not going to happen. This is not going to go on forever. I mean, I don't have a crystal ball. I can't say when it's going to happen. But it leads to we're talking about the human soul writ large here. The human soul burdened with lies and guilt cracks under the pressure at a certain point. You know, you just can't take it anymore. It takes too much psychic energy to keep this thing going. And you seek the release. You want the truth to come out, even if you're going to be punished for it. And I think the same dynamic is at work in large with the body politic.
Well, that's a really good point, Mike. You know, I've been rereading my Dostoevsky, and of course, I'm rereading Brothers Karamazov, but The Crime and Punishment is the classic novel of the person tormented by the guilt of the lies about the crime and all of that. And I imagine some of the 9/11 perps, the ones who are not total natural-born psychopaths, feel the same way. And the whole country does as well, to a certain extent. Even the neocon New Republic magazine. In our next story, we have the New Republic telling us that 9/11 ushered in an Orwellian dystopia. And of course, what they're talking about specifically is the no-fly list, or this so-called TSDB, or database, terrorist database. 1.2 million people are either not allowed to fly or massively tormented when they try to fly. And there's no due process, no public or transparent information about why anybody's on this database, what they can do to get off it. It's like something out of Franz Kafka.
Well, the American people then becomes the enemy of the American government. This is precisely what happened in East Germany, where you had basically 50% of the population spying on the other 50% of the population. By the way, Marcus Wolf was the head of the Stasi in East Germany, and I believe it was Mr. Chertoff brought him over as an advisor to the TSA, to the Homeland Security operation. So this gives you some indication of the roots of what we're talking about here, and the burden that it is placing on these people. You have to keep repressing. It's like you have to hold this wood underwater. That requires energy, because the wood naturally wants to come to surface. You mentioned Brothers Karamazov. The classic American expression of this is Scarlet Letter. You know, where the minister has this burden of adultery on his soul, and he has to restrain himself. He wants to rip open his own shirt. He does it in the middle of the book. You know, he rips open his shirt to expose his chest, the A on his chest, and then at the end he does it in public. And I think something like this is going to happen. The psychological burden will just become too much to bear, and somebody's going to crack and rip open the shirt, and there you'll see the scarlet letter.
Well, I'm still waiting for the New Republic to, you know, have a headline, not just 9/11 brought us Orwellian dystopia, but we neocons did it on purpose by blowing up the trade towers and murdering 3,000 people. I think we'll have to wait a while before the New Republic puts that on their cover. And we also may have to wait a while before the government of Israel admits that it had a major role, maybe the major role in the whole affair. Here was an interesting piece. I think it's kind of a fast and loose approach. I don't know if I would agree with every detail in this article, but I thought it was a very strong and heavily and readable kind of summary of the reasons that so many of us have grown to suspect major Israeli involvement in 9/11.
Well, the question is, it's cui bono, you know, who profited from this? And the immediate answer to that is that Israel, this war, all of the wars, especially the 2000 invasion of Iraq, was done to benefit Israel. It didn't benefit the United States. Nobody in the United States profited from it. We were the ones that gave our treasure and lives.
Wait a minute. Military-industrial complex.
Yes. I mean, the United States, you know what I mean. Okay.
Yeah.
But the point here is that, what was the actual outcome of this? The actual outcome was that, Israel became less secure because, the United States removed the main barrier to Iranian expansion in the region. So with Saddam Hussein gone, Iran expanded its influence through the Shia in Iraq, through Syria, through Hezbollah in Lebanon, and now they have Israel surrounded on the north. And now Israel is even less secure than they were before they removed Saddam Hussein. This is what Hegel calls the cunning of reason. God has a plan here, and man proposes, but God disposes.
Yeah, it's funny how that happens. And I appreciate your insight into these ironies and into this sort of psychological dimension of what's going on at the collective historical level. Well, even as the New Republic was admitting that maybe, you know, this is not such a great thing to turn America into an Orwellian dystopia, we had the whole mainstream basically chanting the official 9/11 myth in unison. And trying to drown out all of the voices of skepticism as this anniversary passed on Wednesday. We have an interesting article that there were different versions of this article in different outlets, but there was a son of one guy who lost his mother on 9/11 who was very angry at Ilhan Omar for saying that some people did something, and this guy was lashing out at her and trying to say, it was the Muslims, it was Al-Qaeda, and so on and so forth. And that seems to be the bottom line of the official story, blame the Muslims.
Yeah, well, that they were the designated villains in this story. But now you're seeing, I think a bigger picture too here is that the Democratic Party has committed itself to identity politics, which means a commitment to some type of diversity politics. And that includes women, and that includes women of color, I guess you could say. And that means Muslim women from the Middle East, from Somalia. And suddenly, again, you see the cunning of reason in action. You got exactly what the type of person you're looking for, but it turns out that they don't like Israel. Now, what are we going to do about that? And this caused a huge crisis in the Democratic Party when Israel refused to, I believe it was this lady and the other lady. Anyway, they refused. These are American legislators who were refused entry into Israel, which happens to be the beneficiary of huge American largesse in terms of foreign aid. So that caused a huge crisis in the Democratic Party. And again, you can see this working here. This was working out of God writing straight with crooked lines, or using human intentions to bring about the opposite of what they intend.
That's right. And so, how about RT? You know, alternative media exploded after 9/11. It was as if the internet was made to give a voice to all of the dissidents and skeptics questioning all of the official stories, especially the official story of this, the biggest, most, you know, perhaps ugliest lie, if not in all of human history, certainly in terms of its effect on huge numbers of people through the media. I think we still have to go back one slide here to the RT story. There we go. So since the founder of RT, Mikhail Lessin, was murdered in Washington, D.C. in his hotel room several years ago, RT just completely stopped covering 9/11 Truth. They stopped inviting me, and they're essentially chanting a lot of the official story along with the mainstream now, including in this story, which is pushing back against the some people did something thing, as well as the New York Times, by comparing it to the New York Times, saying that airliners brought down the towers. And according to RT, it's bad to say that airliners brought down the towers because it was really the evil Muslims who brought down the towers. Well, back before they murdered Lessin, the founder of RT, RT would have published an article saying that the reason that it's bad to say airplanes brought down the towers is because, let's face it, those towers could have withstood probably dozens of hits by airliners the size that hit them and still stood. They would never have exploded into talcum powder at near freefall acceleration through the path of most resistance and disappeared into their own footprints the way they did from airliners. But RT won't tell you that because RT has been taken over by the Zionists.
I have a couple of times I've spoken on RT, and there's always been some this type of initial enthusiasm and warmth, and we exchange these emails, and then the line goes dead. It's always been mysterious to me. I've never figured that out. In contrast to Press TV, where I've been on for years and years and years, and probably said more outrageous things on Press TV than I ever came close to saying on RT. And also, I have this kind of biological connection with Russia. One of my daughter-in-laws is a Russian, and I tried to talk about that. And during the whole Russiagate thing, never went anywhere. So you're probably right. I don't know. I don't know why people think that they have to conform themselves to the criteria or the standards of their oppressors, but happens all the time. The Al Jazeera, it was always a mystery to me. You know, well, I remember the coverage of Gaddafi, the murder of Gaddafi, and why is Al Jazeera taking the side of Hillary Clinton on this thing? I could never figure that one out either. So many things in life you just can't figure out. You probably have the best explanation, better explanation than I do anyway.
Well, I think you can come up with explanations when you look at the details of who's actually running these different operations. And up until 2013 or whenever it was that they killed Lessin, the founder of RT, RT was a voice of 9/11 truth, a very consistent voice of questioning the official story of that and everything else. And it changed overnight when he was murdered. And so clearly there's been a management shift. And my colleagues at Veterans Today, which is plugged into the intelligence community, could give you the details about who these people are that were brought on board and why things have changed at RT. But it's really unfortunate. I wish they would change back, but we can't unmurder the founder of RT, unfortunately.
No.
But over in Iran, In Iran, the alternative media and of course what these Russian and Iranian operations really are is they are English language alternative media outlets that give voice to many Western and American dissidents from different perspectives that never get aired in the mainstream. So they're really amplifying indigenous voices. They're not putting out a propaganda line from some foreign capital. But unfortunately, over in Russia, there is a lot of influence from Israel and its friends in high places. And I think that's the problem with RT. But in Iran, let's go to the next slide. We have Iran's foreign minister, Zarif, accusing the neocon B team of complicity in 9/11. This is yet another case of a high-level person, a government around the world telling a little bit of truth about 9/11. There have been a number of others, Francisco Cossiga, the former president of Italy, Mohamed Morsi of Egypt, the former prime minister, Mahathir Mohamad, and current prime minister, again, of Malaysia, and many, a few others at least, Fidel Castro, Hugo Chavez, and I'm probably forgetting one or two. A bunch of these high-level people have told the truth about 9/11, but this is big because, you know, he's in this big diplomatic conflict with the U.S. right now and saying that, hey, Bolton and his neocon B team did 9/11, or in so many words, is pretty interesting.
Yeah, well, the question is, how much energy does it take to suppress the truth? How can you do this over the long haul? And so the question in particular might be, what effect will the departure of John Bolton have on this ability to suppress the truth? What are we going to see here in the aftermath? Now, I've just saw stories that Trump now will be free to negotiate with Iran now that Bolton's gone. I think that that was always Trump's desire in the first place. Will this allow more freedom? Will this allow an opening here? Or is it so systemic that someone else will just take his place? I don't know whether you were the one who sent me this, but about what are we going to, is Pompeo going to move into the vacuum that's going to be created by Bolton?
We're moving up on those stories. Yeah.
Yeah. Is it systemic, or is it something where one man can change the position? The one man being Donald Trump, who I think always wanted to get out of the wars in the Middle East and then felt thwarted the minute he got into office by the war party.
Mm-hmm. It's going to be interesting to see whether there is the possibility of any shift in this Netanyahu-driven hostility towards Iran now that Bolton's gone. And, you know, Zarif is now, you know, he's accusing the neocon B team of doing 9/11 and being behind the so-called economic terrorism. That's the new talking point out of Tehran. They're saying, you know, calling the sanctions and so on economic terrorism, which is in a sense true. So the firing of Bolton, which is our next slide, I believe, the CNN version of that, may throw a monkey wrench into the works. And I think you're right, Mike, that Trump's instincts are relatively non-interventionist, which makes one wonder why the Kosher Nostra people like the, you know, Las Vegas mob boss Sheldon Adelson, who's very close to Netanyahu, would have worked so hard to put Trump in office. But in any case, Bolton's gone, just like Michael Flynn and H.R. McMaster, the previous national security advisors. So we'll see what happens. And it seems like apparently the key issue that led to this split, or the biggest one of many disagreements with Trump, was that Bolton was horrified by Trump inviting the Taliban's leaders to Camp David. And so that was one of the big scandals this week as well. In any case, now Pompeo may be in a position to move in and become a new Henry Kissinger, and national security advisor, as well as Secretary of State. So let's look at this is the slide of that report. This is from RT. And again, I respect some of what RT does, but just not their 9/11 lies. So you were saying that maybe things will get worse before they get better with Pompeo consolidating power. Maybe Trump will decide to insist on bringing aboard people who agree with him. But who would that be? Is he going to make Rand Paul his next national security advisor? I mean, how could that work?
Well, I said it on Press TV. I said, let's just be happy for the moment, because I don't think anybody could be worse than John Bolton. Is there anyone in the United States who is a bigger warmonger, who is a bigger stooge of the Israel lobby and loyal servant to his master, Sheldon Adelson, than John Bolton? No, I don't think so. But I think more importantly, when John Bolton was appointed, I thought, it's over. You know, it's all over. Trump has completely run up the white flag. He's a complete pawn of the Israel lobby. It's the end. Well, it's not the end, because he got rid of John Bolton. And so the one factor that we need to think about here is Donald Trump's ego. I mean, Donald Trump's ego is bigger than the Israel lobby. I think that this is proof of this. You know, I mean, it's hard to imagine something bigger than the Israel lobby.
Yeah.
But when you're talking about Donald Trump's ego, you're talking about some massive force in the universe, you know? And I think that that's the final thing. And I think Bolton himself said that Trump likes to think of himself as the great negotiator. So you mess with his ability to pull off some type of great deal, like the deal of the century, and you're going to antagonize Trump. And Trump apparently felt that way about him and the Taliban, and he's history. Bolton's history now as a result of that.
And isn't it interesting how Trump, every time he does something like this that looks like it's a step towards peace, he invites the Taliban to Camp David, or he does a breakthrough with North Korea, or he talks nice about Iran, anything like that. It seems like the liberal mainstream media, which is supposed to be more peacenik, beats him up. And it's bipartisan. This week we had all Democrats, Republicans, a bipartisan consensus that it was so offensive and sacrilegious to talk about bringing the Taliban to Camp David right around this sacred 9/11 anniversary of sacred Islamophobia and blaming the Taliban for 9/11, which they had absolutely nothing to do with. They offered to turn bin Laden over. Just show us any evidence against him, we'll send him to America. Don't send us evidence, we'll send him to a neutral country to be tried. And Bush said, we know he's guilty, and bombed the heck out of Afghanistan, which was a war crime. And yet there's this bipartisan consensus that we have to respect the official myth of this 9/11 sacred human sacrifice to incite Islamophobia on behalf of Israel. We have to accept it. So it is interesting. Maybe Trump's ego is bigger than this sort of Zionist-controlled consensus of the major party mainstream.
Well, I think you also have to dispense with these obsolete terms like liberal and conservative. I mean, what do you mean liberal media? Do you mean Jewish media? Can't we just cut to the chase here and get to the heart of the matter by saying that if the Jews control this narrative, and it doesn't matter whether it's liberal or conservative, as long as it fits in with their plan, and certainly Israel is part of their plan. So it's, I think these terms are obsolete. These are the terms of the era before Donald Trump. Donald Trump, in many ways, exploded all of the conventional categories. My favorite moment was Robbie George writing an anathema, a fatwa from National Review excommunicating Donald Trump from the conservative party. I mean, if there were ever a futile gesture, a gesture that just condemned him to irrelevance, it was that type of thing, because Donald Trump exploded conservatism. I mean, he's got all, I'm telling you, there's nothing bigger than Donald Trump's ego, and it explodes all political categories for better or for worse. That's the problem here. This is complete incoherence, okay? You've got a president who is gives defunds Planned Parenthood on one day, on Monday, and then on Tuesday he issues an order saying the United States is going to overturn every anti-sodomy law in the world. If you can find some coherence there, let me know. But I think the only thing that unites this is Donald Trump's ego and his desire to be reelected.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you're onto something there. Of course, I always push back against the notion of talking about the Jews, especially, you know, in a very broad historical sweeping view, like, you know, Guyon's book From Yahweh to Zion, then, well, sure, I suppose you can talk in those broad sweeping terms. But I think in the United States today, we have a real difference between the, you know, sort of liberal left-leaning faction of independent-minded Jews versus the neoconservative and Likudnik Jews. And then there are, of course, there are plenty of truth-telling Jews as well, people I have on the show as guest commentators. So this is another obligatory disclaimer, Mike, because, you know, we're getting strikes on our YouTube channel all the time when we bring on people like some of our recent commentators who use that J word. And so I am obliged to push back and say that in today's politics, it's a little more complicated than that. There are clashes between different forces that include people of Jewish ethnicity and or religion, quite different, you know, on different sides of some of these battles.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying. There has never been a time when the Jews haven't been divided among themselves, and there's never been a time where they didn't function as a unified political body. So you could go back to the gospel which gives Christians an inestimable advantage in understanding this. And you have the Sadducees and the Pharisees. Of course, they were fighting each other. Paul exploited this by saying that, talking about rising from the dead, and immediately the Sadducees started attacking the Pharisees because they disagreed on that. But they did come together and decide to kill Jesus Christ. And the benefit you have from understanding that, as you understand, there is a concept called the Jews. I fight with this all the time. It's like being back in the Middle Ages with the nominalist crisis. The nominalist crisis. Are there universals or are there not universals? Mm-hmm. There are universals. And we can talk about this group. And it's one of the fundamental battles that we have to fight right now. Because what the ADL calls hate speech is basically anything the Jews don't like. That's what it's come down to. They are the agent of that group of people. If there weren't a group of people behind them, they wouldn't have the power that they have.
Well, you know, there certainly is a double standard regarding Jews and Muslims, Jews and other people in various respects. And an example of that is our next story. I mean, look at this. Who's Trump's new Mideast envoy? Well, he just fired Jason Greenblatt, who, of course, is Jewish and neoconservative. Now, why would you have a radical supporter of Israel, the Jewish state, as the United States Middle East envoy? U.S. is supposed to be balanced, right? Well, I don't think so. And who did they replace Greenblatt with? A 29-year-old guy whose his only qualification is being a friend of Jared Kushner. I mean, this guy just graduated from law school a couple of years ago, had an inconsequential job in the Trump administration. His only qualification is being a Jewish friend of Jared Kushner, whose only qualification is being a Jewish in-law of Donald Trump, who can mediate between Trump and what we can only call Jewish power, which, again, as I insist, is not one unified thing, but I don't think that the J word is inappropriate in discussing the fact that this kind of ethnic nepotism on steroids is allowed to go on with very little notice from the mainstream media.
Well, I've written about this. What you're talking about is Jewish privilege. I mean, we hear something called white privilege, which of any group there certainly is, doesn't exist there in any way, shape, or form. But there is something called Jewish privilege, and what you're seeing is a classic example of why is this guy qualified for the job? Well, because he's Jewish. That supersedes any other form of qualification. That trumps any type of discourse, any type of objection. It's Jewish privilege. And in many ways, what we're talking about here from beginning to end is one form of Jewish privilege after another. It's that simple. And if we can't address this problem, then we better look into another line of work, because this is the crucial issue of our age. Are the people of the United States allowed to talk about this group of people that has inordinate privilege in this culture? That we have a group like the ADL whose main job is to keep Jewish criminals from going to jail by accepting bribes from these people. And now we have handed over the entire stewardship of the internet to this group of people, of money launderers and character assassins. That's Jewish privilege, and it's got to stop. If we can't address that issue, we just better go home and do something else.
Well, you know, your point may be borne out in terms of the internet control by problems that we're going to have by putting this on YouTube. So let's hope that whoever they've hired to censor us thinks a little bit about this and ponders whether you have the free speech right to respect, to express these views, which are totally natural, normal views for someone in your position to have. So speaking of media failures, I mean, the media not talking about this, who's the Mideast envoy and what qualifications do they have? And are they balanced, fair and balanced between the, you know, hundreds of millions of Arabs in the Middle East and the handful of Jewish invaders and occupiers? Likewise, the media isn't asking about Trump manipulating the stock market. So, you know, let's be fair and balanced here and admit that Trump, with his gigantic ego, he's a gigantic criminal in a lot of ways. You know, he's been laundering money for organized crime throughout his whole career. You know, he was created by Roy Cohn, who was the mob lieutenant who ran New York for Meyer Lansky and his underling J. Edgar Hoover. And that's the guy who put Trump in business, laundering money through hotels and gambling joints. That's what Trump has done throughout his career. And this criminal and you know, crappy businessman who makes money simply by, you know, it's who you know and working with these mobbed up characters laundering their money, and he still goes bankrupt. This guy is like making trillions of dollars for people by tweeting things that cause the markets to go way up real fast or to crash, and so you can short them. I mean, this is so obvious, and my intelligence professional people, friends and colleagues for Betters Today say this is like, there's no question this is happening. You know, he's tweeting about China trade deals killing the market, right? 300-point drop the day that the trade sanctions go in. And the people that know this is coming are making huge piles of money by shorting the market, and the media won't talk about it. So this is another area of media failure, and I'm not sure this has to do with anybody's ethnicity, but what does it have to do with? Why does the media bash Trump about irrelevant things and dubious things and let him get away with this?
Because the same people that control Wall Street control the media. I don't want to get into who that group is. I want to keep you on YouTube.
No.
Kevin, I don't want to sound obsessive here, but you keep drawing me back into the same area where the same group of people keep running the same operation. Maybe we should talk about baseball at this point or something like that. Wait a minute.
The plutocracy and the criminal networks within the plutocracy, they do sometimes welcome people from a broad variety of ethnic viewpoints into their criminal organizations. I mean, they're equal opportunity employers. Isn't the mafia somewhat of an equal opportunity employer? I mean, not every rich criminal type is necessarily of any particular ethnicity. Let's look at Donald Trump, for example.
Look, this is why I called my book The Jewish Revolutionary Spirit. Okay, I am not a believer in the determinism of DNA. I do not believe that any group of people is determined by their DNA. The human behavior is a function of the mind, and the mind is a function of whether you accept the moral order or reject it. Okay, so that's what I believe. So that means that you don't have to be a Jew to be Jewish. You don't have to be a Jew to act like a Jew. If you're promoting the things that the Jews promote, they will welcome you. And what are we talking about? Usury, traditionally. You know, I mentioned this story in the Jewish Revolutionary Spirit. Jewish convert in the Middle Ages by the name of Pfefferkorn converted to Catholicism because the Dominicans talked to him. Part of that great conversion campaign that basically emptied Western Europe of Jews. And he said, if I were still taking usury, I'd still be a Jew. Well, this is a significant admission. You're talking about a content here. If you talk about a guy like Yuri Slezkind, who wrote the book The Jewish Century, he says, during the course of the 20th century, everybody became a Jew. This means that there is a behavior out there that I have isolated as low rejection of logos. If you're collaborating with this rejection of logos, there you have allies, and that's a group of people that have been doing this for a long time, and they will welcome you as your ally, as their ally.
Okay, well, I don't think I'm going to stop drawing you into this kind of talk, because our next topic gets even more, you know, it's more irresistible to talk about it this way, the Jeffrey Epstein scandal over at henrymccoe.com. And Henry McCoe is of Jewish ancestry, and now he's a notorious anti-Semite, but go figure. In any case, he put up this story, and I think he took it back down. I think it looks like it was a highly dubious story about a supposed new Epstein victim, but it looks like it may not be something that's very reliable, which is a lesson that we should always be skeptical about what we see in the alternative media as well as what we see in the mainstream media. So let's get on to the more solid Jeffrey Epstein-related material here. The next story, how about this Hoichi Ito, who is definitely not Jewish, he's Japanese. He is, boy, it's, you know, how did this guy get to be head of MIT Media Labs? He's a college dropout. He ran a nightclub in a very, you know, criminal district of Tokyo, specializing in all sorts of disgusting, nefarious stuff. Too disgusting to be mentioned on a family news show here. And now he finally resigned because he was taking vast piles of money from Jeffrey Epstein, laundered money connected to Jeffrey Epstein that was given by Bill Gates, and on and on and on. So the Jeffrey Epstein scandal still lives. And so what do you think about Ito and the MIT Media Labs, Mike?
It's a clear example of Japanese privilege. Oh, wait a minute. I didn't write that book yet.
That'll hey, be careful. Don't use that J word. No J words on this show. No Japanese privilege.
Or a Jap. It was a Jewish American princess. There's the connection there. I knew there was a connection here.
Oh, man.
I don't know. Let me write that. Let me write that book.
Yeah. We're going to talk about the next show. Cue up Frank Zappa's Jewish American princess song and really make sure we get banned. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. But I mean, so Jeffrey, let's talk about Jeffrey Epstein. He got a sweetheart deal because of the organization I just mentioned, the ADL. There was a prosecutor down in Florida by the name of Kirshner who got an award from the ADL. And this guy is the guy who gave Epstein the sweetheart deal that let him off the hook. Okay, so again, I'm saying about the ADL, I hope my friends at the ADL aren't offended by this. I mean, the ADL, I have to say, are my most faithful subscribers. We never have to send a second renewal notice to the ADL because they buy that magazine. They read it faithfully every month. So I thank the ADL for reading Culture Wars faithfully. But the fact of the matter is...
Well, they're watching the ADL, your show, too.
They are watching our show. Thanks you. Thanks, Mr. Greenblatt, for all of your support over the past years. But the fact of the matter is that this is one more substantiation of the fact that the ADL exists to keep Jewish criminals out of jail. That's what they do. That's what they do for a living. So why are these people in charge of telling me what I'm allowed to say on the internet? Why are they doing who gave them this right? How long is it forever that they have this right, or has it changed? And I'm saying, I think it's changed because of what happened to PewDiePie just 2 days ago. I don't know whether you saw this, but PewDiePie announced he was going to get $50,000. PewDiePie is the biggest guy on the internet. He's a Swedish guy, and he's got 100 million followers on YouTube. They watch him play video games for some strange reason. Anyway, he announced...
Yeah, I never figured that out.
I never figured it out either, but there are many mysteries to life. So anyway, PewDiePie says, I'm going to give $50,000 to the ADL. Like, this is a noble gesture. You know, we're supposed to stand up and cheer. Well, the pushback was enormous because all of the people who were basically PewDiePie supporters are saying, why are you putting weapons into the hands of our enemies? The ADL is the main source of censorship on the internet. Why are you doing this? And one day later, PewDiePie backed down and retracted the offer. Now, this is a sign that consciousness has arisen now, that Logos is rising, because it's the same thing with 9/11. It's the same thing with a false flag operation. We all know too much now, and we all know too much about the ADL, and we're just not going to take it. And he, the leader of 100 million people, had to back down because 99 million of them understand that the ADL is what I said it was.
So even people who watch somebody play video games on YouTube, even those people know about this stuff now.
That's
amazing.
Right. That's right. I mean, the pushback was enormous. Just go and do a Google search with PewDiePie. All of the mass media outlets that did a story on this is incredible. Like the New York Post, it was huge news because it was the first time, I think, that someone told the truth about the ADL. I think this is a massive turning point in American history. because now suddenly people are awakening to the fact of what they're, who they are. We know who you are. We know about you and Meyer Lansky. We know about the ADL and Mo Dalitz and all these criminals, all the way up to Jeffrey Epstein, and we're not taking it anymore.
Okay, well, I hope whoever they're hiring to watch us on YouTube and decide whether we're allowed to continue will think about this. We don't have 100 million subscribers like PewDiePie. I think we should have a few more than we do. But in any case, I don't know why these criminals have the right to decide what's seen on the internet either. I'm with you on that part, Mike. And how about this next story for background on the Edo MIT Labs Jeffrey Epstein scandal? There's an old article from 2013 or 14, I think. 2013 came out after Aaron Schwartz, a Jewish hero, by the way. There are lots of heroic Jewish people as well as nefarious ones, at least according to this interpretation, which says that Aaron Schwartz was not being prosecuted and harassed and persecuted just because he was trying to take these university, you know, publicly available databases and make them a little bit more easier to access. He was persecuted because he was part of this huge pushback against the child porn ring led by people like Ito in MIT Labs. Now, I don't know for sure that this is true, but I found this report to be unsettlingly convincing, and it points out that Nicholas Negroponte was a co-founder of this MIT lab. He's the brother of John Death Squad Negroponte, who specializes in organizing these death squads to torture and murder the political enemies of whichever corrupt group is trying to take over and corrupt the country. And we won't mention the ethnic group that those people are from. It has to do with Greece, and they're so. I guess we can say that they're from Greece, and hopefully they won't take us off the internet for mentioning the Greece connection of the Negropontes. But we won't mention the other ethnic connection, which is by now far too well known. Anyway, Ito, the Japanese J-word guy, was running corrupt nightclubs in the drug and prostitution district. A college dropout, and then somehow Negroponte, brother of the Death Squad guy, and very dicey character himself, brought him into the media lab. And according to this report, MIT Labs and a lot of other high-tech labs in American universities are heavily into child porn, child prostitution, and they go over to Southeast Asia on junkets, and there's a huge activist network trying to stop them. So this is really important background. The mainstream has never reported it.
Well, I think that what is the point of the Jeffrey Epstein case? It is basically the use of sexuality to compromise people so that you can blackmail them. You want to invite influential people here into compromising situations, and the only compromising situation that's left is basically child sex trafficking. Okay. You can't, it used to be homosexuals could be blackmailed, but now proof of that era is gone, is now we have the homosexual mayor of South Bend bragging about his homosexuality, an example of what I could legitimately call homosexual privilege. He's got homosexual privilege, okay? But to get back to Epstein, you're allowed to talk about Epstein, and you're allowed to talk about this in a very narrow circumstances, but you're not allowed to talk about the bigger ramifications, which is that the Jews were notorious for their involvement in prostitution in Europe. And when they moved here, they brought that notoriety with them. The classic example is Zvi Migdal in Argentina, the prostitution ring that would lure unsuspecting Jewish women over here and enslave them in white slavery. This was well known. This is what Jeffrey Epstein was doing. And if a Japanese guy shows expertise in this trade, well, why wouldn't you hire him? Because the goal is the same. You need these tech guys, okay? How are you going to get access to the tech guys to compromise them? Well, make them head of something at MIT, because you throw the money around. If you throw enough money at Harvard, they'll hire the guy. You've thrown enough money at MIT. We've already seen that with these other scandals, okay? They will hire the guy if you have an influential person throwing money at them, and then he can use his position to ensnare the tech guys, the big tech guys in the same net, and they will then do what you're told. So that when the ADL shows up and to the head of Google or whatever it is and say, this and these are the new laws you are going to implement, and if you say no, well, then they'll say, well, wait a minute, I have a picture of you here with a 12-year-old girl on a flight to an island in the Caribbean. And if you don't do what I say, well, then we're going to expose that. This is the way the system works. What's the big mystery here? The big mystery is you're not allowed to make the connections. You're supposed to keep this in a very isolated fashion so that nobody will understand how this ramifies into a system of control.
Absolutely right. And if you want to know how it ramifies into a system of control, check out the series that Whitney Webb has been publishing over at Mint Press News. That's our next slide and her most recent entry in this. And shout out to Whitney Webb, who's doing some real journalism, which is an endangered species these days, is how the CIA, Mossad, and the Epstein Network are exploiting mass shootings to create an Orwellian nightmare. And she's talking about this Carbine 9/11, note the 9/11 in the name, a spinoff from Unit 8200, an Israeli military intelligence division, is selling these emergency response technological programs and devices all over the world, including in the United States. And apparently, according to various reports, that Google, Microsoft, and Facebook are just infested with graduates from Unit 8200. So this might be part of the reason why we can't criticize certain groups of criminals and certain foreign states on the internet without getting shut down. Now, this article is very interesting, Mike, and it's mentioning Ehud Barak. He turns up in several of these stories we reported. Ehud Barak was in the BBC office when 9/11 happened, so he could immediately go on television, blame bin Laden, and call for a war on terror. He had the whole script in front of him, and he was sitting in the BBC offices before 9/11 happened on the morning of September 11, 2001. Ehud Barak is also a close friend of Jeffrey Epstein, an associate of Jeffrey Epstein, presumably a handler of Epstein, and he is both the financial financier and the chairman of Carbine, a spinoff from Unit 8200 that is infiltrating the tech sector, as well as infiltrating all of the big tech companies. I mean, so they're clear about they're trying to make Israel the tech leader, to control the tech high ground and basically rule the world that way. And this, many of these points that you've been making apply in space to all of this. And I think people who aren't familiar with this should go and read this whole series on Jeffrey Epstein that Whitney Webb has published at Mint Press News.
Yeah, I also think you need a bigger picture explanation. And that's what I tried to do with my book, Libido Dominandi, which is about sexual liberation as a form of political control. You have to understand how this works, why it works, and then you can understand why the subversion of our culture took place during the 1960s, when you got large numbers of people basically to abandon rationality in the area of sexuality and gave it into their passions. St. Augustine said,
We have 10 minutes left, so let's talk about the 60s in the context of the Israeli relationship to the U.S. White House. In the next story, we have Israel caught planting stingrays to spy on the Trump administration's cell phone calls. They were planting stingrays around the White House. This is mainstream news. This isn't some alternative outlet. And in the next slide after this, we see that Israel's interest in the White House goes way, way back. There's a long story, too long to cover here, but here I am getting pushback at the Jihad Watch Islamophobic website in an article by Robert Spencer. He didn't like my interview on Press TV where I mentioned that I didn't say Jews killed these guys. I said that the State of Israel was involved in these assassinations, and I cited the research of French historian Laurent Guyenot, author of From Yahweh to Zion. And in the next slide, we see that the short version of this is available at UNS.com, Did Israel Kill the Kennedys? So Israel and the U.S. White House, the killing of the Kennedys and the sexual revolution of the 60s, this was a huge transformation of American culture. And so you can pick up on that. Is there a relationship between the corruption of killing the Kennedys and the corruption of what happened to the culture with the sexual revolution?
Yes, absolutely. That book that I mentioned about Meyer Lansky and the Cincinnati Ballet was a crucial story at that time. A Notre Dame quarterback became sheriff in Newport, Kentucky, and he decided he's going to clean up the mob in Newport, Kentucky. Well, that mob is Jewish. That's Mo Dalitz. That's Meyer Lansky. These are the people that run the mob in Newport, Kentucky. And the reason he was successful, it's an interesting story. He goes, the casino owners invite him in for a drink. He takes the drink, and there's enough chloral hydrate in it to kill the entire Notre Dame football team. He wakes up in a bed with a stripper with no clothes on, and they're going to prosecute him. He wins the election, and at that point, the Kennedys hear about it, and Bobby Kennedy sends the FBI down to clean up Newport, Kentucky. Now, these people never forgave Robert Kennedy for doing this type of thing. He also prosecuted a man by the name of Ginsburg, who did a magazine called Eros, and it was a successful obscenity prosecution at this time. This is what the Kennedys stood for. We have a lot of character assassination going on about John F. Kennedy's love life, but when you come down to the practical implementation of policy and the use of agencies like the FBI, it was against this group of people. And they had a motive for killing him as a result of that. There's no question about it.
And according to Guglielmo's work, the biggest motive was that JFK was dedicated to shutting down Israel's nuclear program. Right. There's a huge story around that, and I urge people to read the article to get the details, because we only have a few minutes left here. So let's move on to our, here we're going to get, I'm sure, banned from the internet for Islamophobia by talking against Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is, of course, a puppet state of Wahhabi desert bandits, criminals, and Bedouin idiots who have been manipulating oil markets on behalf of the world's biggest financial cartels, Wall Street and their friends forever. And in this story, we see that it looks like they're going to have to take some oil off the market to prevent a glut. Why would anyone want to do that? Well, the next slide, we see the Oil Card by James Norman. It was a terrific book published almost a decade ago now, I think, that laid out how the U.S. won the Cold War by knocking oil prices down, pushing them down through the floor to bankrupt the former Soviet Union. And now they're pushing oil prices up in order to, for a while they pushed them up, and now they're pushing them back down again to mess once again with Russia and with Iran. And the Saudis are a big part of this. The Saudis follow the orders of the world's biggest criminal psychopathic financiers. And not only do the Saudis do that, but they also are traitors to their own people. The Arabs and the Muslims, and now they're persecuting Palestinians in Saudi Arabia. They just arrested Dr. Mohammed Saleh al-Qudari, who is a representative of Hamas in Saudi Arabia. I don't think we're going to get banned for talking against the Saudis. They're not going to ban us for Islamophobia for that. But, there are certain people you can talk about and certain people you can't. Hello, Mike, are you there? Looks like we've lost E. Michael Jones temporarily, either that or I've lost myself. So I'll keep going here, assuming that I'm still broadcasting. We only have a couple of stories left. I don't see the slides either, so I'm wondering whether somehow I got knocked off the air. Okay, we're back. But Mike's not. Hello, Mike. Come back, Mike. All right, we've only got a couple of minutes left here. So we have Iranian MPs. In this story, are proposing that the sanctioned countries, Iran, North Korea, Russia, even China, should get together and push back against these sanctions. And of course, this is what's going to happen the more they sanction these countries, the more these countries are going to find a way to beat the sanctions, mostly by getting out of U.S. dollar trade. And Iran is spearheading this. Iran is the most sanctioned country. They're under the most brutal sanctions, which Zarif is now calling economic terrorism. And I suppose it is, because they're terrorizing these countries by taking away plane parts so the planes crash, or taking away medical equipment so that people die, didn't have to die. I would call that terrorism. They're spreading the fear. They're trying to promote fear of themselves in order to get their way. So these people are economic terrorists, and maybe the pushback will be successful, God willing. Our next story, the Indian military is ready to invade the Pakistani-administered part of Kashmir, which is supposed to be, well, it's originally was supposed to be part of Pakistan. The deal was that the Muslim majority areas are Pakistan, the Hindu majority areas are India, but through some chicanery, India was able to steal Kashmir, and they've been brutally oppressing the Muslim majority population ever since, and now they're planning to take away Kashmir's status as an independent entity, or a semi-independent entity, even though it is occupied by India. Mike, are you back?
Yeah, I'm back.
Hey, okay, good. I see your picture. I don't see you. Looks like we had some kind of crash. Oh, it looks like somebody censored you here. Was that Pete Buttigieg sneaking through the alley and shutting you down?
I don't know. We'll have to do some research here.
Okay.
Can you hear me?
We can hear you. We can't see anything but a picture of you with duct tape across your face. That looks like ADL brand duct tape.
Yeah. Oh, sorry. I don't know what happened.
I can see you're getting annoyed. I don't either. There you are. We got you. Okay, you're back.
Okay.
We're just mentioning, yeah, that India is making noises about invading the Pakistani-administered part of Kashmir and thereby starting World War III. My take on this is that Modi is a complete genocidal maniac. And if, you know, we could bring Israel into it and point out that their Israel is very tight with the RAW services, and especially the extreme Hindu fascist element in India, which is causing this whole problem and possibly is about to plunge the world into nuclear World War III.
Yeah, Modi's the head of the BJP, and they're playing a double game in India. They're opening the country to the oligarchic exploitation. Basically, every piece of clothing you buy in the United States at places like Gap is produced in India for slave wages. And in order to make that exploitation palatable, the BJP is demonizing Christians and in particular Catholics in India. These people, nuns are being murdered, and the BJP, Modi's party, won't say a word about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's funny. They're persecuting the Muslims there, of course, and I hear about that through my Islamic channels. But a lot of people may not have heard about the persecution of Christians in India. All we ever hear about is the persecution of Christians in Muslim countries, supposedly by Muslims. There is some of that, unfortunately, although I think it's been exaggerated. And we get that, of course, from the propaganda from the usual suspects. But nobody ever talks about the persecution of Christians by these Hindu fascists in India.
No, it's a very dangerous place. In general, it's a very dangerous place. And it's a very violent group of people there. And that's not the way we perceive them over here. So the Christians are taking the brunt of basically Modi's policy of doing the bidding of the oligarchs. He has to channel that aggression, that unhappiness somewhere. And he's using the Christians as the lightning rod and making them the source of all of India's problems.
Interesting. Well, you know, in some ways, it's got to be tough to be a really serious Christian, as you are, in today's world. And, you know, here in the United States, a supposedly Christian country, the Christian worldview and Christian morality seems like it's been heavily uprooted. And there's so many examples of this. You know, if the world plunges into nuclear war tomorrow because of Kashmir, maybe we won't care about the last story that we're covering, which is the drag queen story hour protests in Chula Vista, California. But there is something sort of emblematic about this, where, you know, now drag queens are reading stories to little children, And this is supposed to embody tolerance and all of these liberal virtues. And then there are protesters in the parking lot, but they didn't disrupt the event. And so, you know, the final line in this story from the San Diego paper was quoting a supporter of the drag queens who attended the event, saying, "The whole room was filled with positive energy. I almost felt like crying." Well, I'm sure some of the Christians who share your perspective might probably felt like crying too.
Well, is pedophilia bad, Kevin? Isn't this an enabling device for pedophilia, or am I just, is that just me? Am I the only guy who thinks this?
I don't know if I'd put it quite that strongly, but it does seem that there's something really dubious. There's this sexualization of children, especially in these perverse ways, strikes me as a symptom of extreme cultural decadence, something very unpleasant, something I wouldn't really want my kids to be involved in. What people want to do in their private lives, if they're not corrupting public morals, is their own business. But libraries with drag queen story hour does seem a little odd to me, but, you know, what do I know?
We have them in South Bend, thanks to our gay mayor. This is the new agenda. How about Catholic priests reading stories to children at public libraries?
Wouldn't that violate the separation of church and state?
I knew you were going to say that, Kevin. I knew you were going to say that. You would be the first one to call up the ACLU probably and say that.
I would, to tell you the truth, I would much prefer Catholic priests reading stories to children at the libraries than the drag queens doing it. So
I can't,
you know, call
how
me a reactionary.
Is this possible? God, the world has come to a strange state of affairs where suddenly drag queens can read to children and proselytize them for an agenda that will lead to their sexual exploitation sooner or later, and probably sooner, given the predilections of some of these people. But hey, we're not allowed to criticize.
I guess, next it's going to be, you know, call up the local drag queens to come read the bedtime stories to your kids. And, you know, good night, ladies. Ladies, good night. It's time to say goodbye. Okay, so it is time to say goodbye. Thank you, Dr. E. Michael Jones. I appreciate your great work and your courage in calling it exactly the way you see it and taking the flack that comes with that. We'll be back next week with Barry Zwicker, who's actually basically a liberal, left-leaning, atheist agnostic, who has a totally different set of worldviews from you, but would probably agree on quite a few of these things. That's what we do at False Flag Weekly News. We're interested in the smartest people from the most interesting viewpoints. You qualify. Thanks. Keep up the great work. We're at Culture Wars, and I look forward to talking again.
Thank you, Kevin.